COTA just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your COTA fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with COTA. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Hello.
Do I do it?
No. I was gonna...
Boys and girls, your attention, please. Presenting a new exciting radio program, faster than an airplane, more powerful than a locomotive, impervious to bullets.
Beware, comic phobes. You've stumbled upon a very thought bubble episode of Storm of Spoilers. If you're just joining us for the first time, we're here to answer all your questions about comics and comics-adjacent culture. Some of us are so-called experts, and some of us are your friendly neighborhood novices, but this podcast is meant for comic lovers of all levels. If we plan on going in-depth or spoilery on any subject, we'll be sure to give you ample warning. So grab your hammers, lassos of truth, head into the Speed Force, and without further ado, let's get on with the show. Dave, one of our comrades, has fallen down, if not
okay,
literally.
We have no evidence that Neil Miller has literally fallen down.
His health has fallen down.
Yeah, let's dispel with that fear. Just ill, slash at a film festival seeing, you know, the movies of the year before the rest of us. So, partial pity.
But in the snow and ice, so maybe also has literally fallen down. We'll have to wait till next week to find out. But in the meantime, you and I are going to talk a little bit about comics and comic book TV and comic book films, which is something we used to do on a weekly basis, but now we only do basically when Neil has fallen down in some way or another.
Or when something especially comic booky happens.
Yeah.
This is the former.
Yes. So, you know, but we're still going to do some of our regular Storm of Spoilers business. So I will kick off by doing some reviews. Joanna, do you have some reviews for us to read? Why, yes, Joanna, I do have some reviews for us to read.
All prepared this time.
I didn't want to let the host, which is myself, down this time. So we've got some foreign, we don't have any new USA reviews, so I'm going to read some foreign reviews that we got. And if you are in the good old US of A and want to leave us a review on iTunes, we would much appreciate it. But in the meantime, thank you so much for some reviews around the world. This one comes from Prometheus128 from Nigeria, who says, "As you were, please, 4 stars. My name is Albert from Nigeria, and for lack of a creative way to say this, I'll just go with, I really love this podcast. Yay! I started listening to A Cast of Kings many, many years ago, and it led me here to A Storm of Spoilers. It's fast become a great accompanying recap show to listen to while doing basically anything that doesn't involve reading other material. I love the cast, and I love the banter. You guys do a great job, even when I'm white-knuckled from clenching my fist in violent disagreement with some of your views. Thank you, thank you, thank you, as you were, please." So, thank you, Prometheus128. Sorry about your knuckles sometimes. This one's a less positive review.
All right.
From Dustin119 from the UK. 1 star. And he says, It's a free cunch, I suppose. And I looked up the word cunch. I put this on Twitter, so you guys might have already seen this. But I looked for the word cunch, C-U-N-T-C-H, on Urban Dictionary. It's a deeply unpleasant word. Anyway. Thought I'd try an off-season special. God damn, you guys have some pent-up snark. I wish Black Mirror would have remained a little niche series on Channel 4, so you may have missed it. Feel free to give Series 5 a miss, unless, of course, you achieve your aim of it being canceled. You clearly don't enjoy it. Vote with your fingers and switch the channel or stream something else. And then, like, angry emoji face with, like, steam coming out of the nostrils. P.S. JR, that's me, Joanna, is so overbearing. I don't know how you guys can deal with the noise. I do enjoy your Game of Thrones chat, though. Sorry, but also not sorry. So, please don't tell Dustin119 about our Iron Fist podcast, because that's actually what it sounds like when we don't like something.
Yeah, I was going to say,
I thought
we
liked
pretty good on
Black Mirror, so I'm a little confused, but, you know, those are some reviews, both positive and non, and, you know, like I said, please do leave us a review on iTunes, if you're from the USA or not, so we can have something else to read next week that doesn't teach me a new swear word. Dave. Since Neil is not here, I was wondering if there was anything that we might have talked about previously that we would want to talk about again on this episode of Storm of Spoilers.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Con of Thrones is in Dallas, Texas this year.
What?
May 25th through 27th.
What?
I don't know if you guys have heard, but it's happening.
Did we talk about this already?
I don't know. I think we've talked about this already.
Oh, okay.
I know for sure Neil is excited that he can legally carry his sword in Texas, but I've never been excited about Texas politics, so I'm just saying, come to Con of Thrones, and we'll talk about Game of Thrones in this off-season. When it's important to, you know, round up the wagons and see who the off-season fans are, that'll be us in Dallas. Get your tickets now. Yeah, and then also in the world of Game of Thrones this week, we got some news about Bridesmaids. And as is Neil's tradition, I'll say what little I know about this, that Maisie Williams is going to be a bridesmaid at Sophie Turner's wedding, which, you know, warms our hearts as people who like to see the people we like on screen get along in real life. And there was also some other more depressing news, which I will throw to Joanna from Maisie Williams.
Well, like, Maisie Williams was asked this question, the question about a bridesmaid thing, and I think she was just like, duh, of course. And I kind of feel the same way. Like, Sophie Turner and Maisie Williams are such apparent best friends that it does not surprise me at all that she'd be part of the wedding. So that's lovely news. I'm sure we will see some photos. It will be adorable. Maybe it'll be a double wedding with Kit Harington. Who knows? Who knows? Game of Thrones people getting married. But Maisie Williams also said in this recent sort of round of interviews that she was worried about getting work after Game of Thrones is over because of the way she looks. And that, yeah, that made me sad. I think Maisie Williams is entirely adorable. So, you know, I hope that is a completely false fear of hers and that, you know, she will have a lot of work post Game of Thrones. And then Peter Dinklage also gave an interview. I forgot to mention this before that he doesn't say anything new, but he sounds really over Game of Thrones. He sounds really ready to not be making Game of Thrones anymore. So, and I mean, it's kind of hard to blame them because, like, I know that we're all excited about Game of Thrones. Obviously, we're going to a whole convention about it. We podcast about it regularly. But I think maybe if you've been working on it for 8 years of your life or what have you, you might be ready to not do it for a while. I'm sure everyone involved will miss it when it's gone, but I can understand if you're in it that you might be over it, especially if you have to, like, talk to tennis balls on sticks and be in the snow and stuff like that.
You can't tell anybody what you're doing. You never have any idea of a greater context of what you're doing. You're talking tennis balls. You can't tell anybody where you go when you go on extremely long flights to other parts of the world. Nobody cares what your hair looks like at all times.
I was about to say, Peter Dinklage has not been in charge of his own facial hair for a long time now, I think. So, yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot to deal with. So, I'm sympathetic, but like, let's check in with them in, like, 5 years, and they'll all be like, oh, my God, remember when I used to get to talk to tennis balls? It was so fun.
Yeah, you got to think that Lena Headey, I was happy when I see her in Game of Thrones because I feel she got the short shaft on the Terminator series.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's got to be some members of the cast that are like, no, I've been on not successful shows and are super happy about it. But Peter Dinklage, force of nature, can do whatever he wants.
There we go. So we talked about this already. And that is a segment that we usually do on Storm of Spoilers. But up next is going to be something that we only do on Thought Bubble. Are you ready, Dave?
Yay. Yeah, I'm ready.
All right. This is a section we like to call What We've Been Reading. And when we did Thought Bubble regularly, it was sort of, hey, this is what we've been reading week to week, comic book wise. Since we have not been doing Thought Bubble regularly, I've fallen off of my comic book consumption. So a couple days ago, 2 days ago, yesterday, whenever it was that we determined we were doing this, that's when Joanna started cramming comic books so she'd have something to talk about. So we're going to start with Dave, who is a more regular comics reader than I am, and then we'll get to, like, what Joanna's been cramming. But Dave, what have you been reading in a more leisurely fashion?
I've been keeping up with of course, the Marvel Star Wars line, so I can make sure that my Star Wars universe knowledge is as complete as possible, but otherwise have been laying off Marvel as a company completely. I understand that Ms. Marvel had a really good year in 2017, in terms of a couple of different arcs that really hit home with some people and some different audiences, but those audiences were not me. I am still abstaining from mainstream Marvel. At first, it was because Ike Perlmutter supported the Trump presidency in the way that he did. Then it was because the Marvel executives seemed to just keep doing that thing that Sideshow Bob does with the rakes in The Simpsons, where every time they try to pivot, they just pivot into another rake to the face. I'm still not super happy with how that company's being run and how they respond to their own fandom having opinions. So as a result, I've been reading mostly DC comics. All-Star Batman came to a conclusion last year and was fantastic. It ended with an arc, that was an Alfred-centric arc.
Ooh.
Which, yeah, you know, at first when I was like, this is how you're going to close it out with like a 6-issue Alfred arc, I was like, this is dumb. But I was stupid for doubting Scott Snyder and All-Star Batman, because All-Star Batman is my favorite run of Batman since Snyder's reboot run of Batman. So the guy just keeps making gold when he does Batman. I think he has a way of understanding how Bruce Wayne and Alfred's mind work as part of like this detective family that is capable of great action, but also parsing a lot of information. So while we're with Alfred, they really early on go on like a pirate-like adventure, and there are little factoids about Blackbeard as, you know, Bruce Wayne tries to get illicit chemicals. Not important, but as it all builds, the story of, you know, Alfred and Bruce's relationship gets strengthened. And that's one of those things that you take for granted that those two are always together, but very few Batman stories, I think, actually do that well. All-Star Batman got to. Otherwise, I've been trying to keep up and catch up. Around last November, when I think we got a question on it on this podcast, I decided to try to keep up with the Doomsday Clock.
Yeah.
Or catch up with what was happening with the greater DC universe. The Doomsday Clock, I think, is going to be 12 issues, one of those. Either way, there's only two out, so we're really at the beginning of what's sort of happening, even though this was first teased 18 months ago with the New 52, and then there was sort of a Batman Flash crossover event called The Button in the Middle, which sort of revealed a little bit more. The Doomsday Clock crossover event is bringing the world of the Watchmen into the DC universe, or quite literally bringing some of the Watchmen characters into the DC universe, where they are trying to hunt down the missing Dr. Manhattan, who has hidden himself in the DC universe at some time. The interesting thing about the Doomsday Clock issues is there have been releases online of in-world articles, and then most of those are reproduced in the back of the issue as if somebody's reading them on an iPad. And there's not only a whole bunch of backstory about how Wayne Enterprises and LexCorp are sort of in this corporate espionage thing, but it all centers around this greater idea called the superhuman theory, or the Superman theory,
huh,
which is that the U.S. government has been manufacturing superhumans because somebody did a study in the DC 52 universe that 12% of the world population is a metahuman, and the vast majority of them are in America, which posed the question, why are they in America, which started this conspiracy theory that it was actually a government project. But Rorschach, who's on the trail of trying to find Dr. Manhattan, is with Ozymandias, who also theorizes that maybe Dr. Manhattan actually created the superheroes in the DC universe at a certain point. There's a lot of references to the Invasion crossover, which happened in the late 80s. People might be a little bit more familiar with it because it was the basis for the DC television show crossover last year. with the Dominators coming down to Earth. In the comic book, the Dominators set off a gene bomb, which is one of the first times the DC universe dealt with the fact that there are so many superheroes. And so that was one of the first times the universe proper dealt with the idea of there being some sort of metahuman gene. A few people online have speculated, and there's nothing to prove it wrong yet, that Dr. Manhattan actually enters the DC universe during the invasion crossover and helps sort of either bring the Dominators about or populate the universe with metahumans, because the invasion crossover happened in 88 and Watchmen was 87, and Manhattan leaves Watchmen at the end to find a new universe. And the idea that is presented in Doomsday Clock is that he crossed over in the DCEU and has been running his own experiments here for we don't know how long. Yeah, it's interesting.
I forgot what this is like.
It's been really good for people that have been liking what this relaunch of the DC universe means, which is accepting all sorts of DC continuity back into the fold and like tweaking it. There's a lot of hints that the Justice Society of America is going to come back, like classic Green Lantern that was made by an explosion at an iron factory, not ring bearing space corp person. So like much like Marvel did a few years ago with Secret Wars, where they tried to mesh all their continuity together so that they could come out trumpeting what they were really about as a brand. Doomsday Clock looks like it's going in that direction. We haven't spent a whole bunch of time with the DC heroes yet in the crossover event, but to be fair, we've been spending all this time in the publishing world about them, and all indications are they're going to try to pull it all together and make it all feel substantive. What I wasn't ready for with Doomsday Clock is how much the first issue updates Reagan imagery to be about Trump, but without necessarily, being in our universe. I think Doomsday Clock picks up 7 years after Watchmen ends, so it's in the middle of the 90s. But there's a lot of making America great again sort of imagery and language on the tip of this Cold War with Russia. So I don't know how much of that was intentional and how much dystopia we've stumbled into just by being a country, but it is interesting to see that they had to flee the Trumpish world into the DCEU to find Dr. Manhattan. So yeah, I'm it's fairly successful. It has a lot to live up to as a Watchmen sequel, and I don't think it's going to succeed as that, but as a commentary on what the DC universe has done in between Watchmen and now, I think it has a chance of being a lot more successful. So where I had no idea what was happening a few months ago, I'm now fully on board with Doomsday Clock, or at least the Doomsday Clock mystery. It's my kind of mystery.
Excellent.
You thought I was done. Quaint. Okay. One more plug though.
Yeah.
Cause I know where you're going to want to talk about Korra too.
Yeah.
The newest issue of Superman number 39. It's called Goodnight Moon. It's written by Peter J. Tomasi and Patrick Gleason. Joanna, I would suggest maybe picking this one up.
Really?
It is the Hallmark movie of superhero comics.
Wait. Okay. Why do you think Hallmark movie and Joanna in the same sentence?
I'm not feminizing you, but as our...
How dare you treat me like a woman.
As our discussion of what goes wrong so many times in DC movies and DC properties have to do with not seeing these characters really stand for the same things that we thought they did, or that they were as symbols. Goodnight Moon is a great example of the Justice League, who very quickly foil a crime across the street from a children's hospital and decide to treat the children's cancer patients to like a day of adventure they go on a scavenger hunt for things like Superman's cape, and they get to go to the Justice League headquarters. And one of the things on the scavenger hunt is a photograph of Batman smiling, and that has to resolve itself in a completely adorable way. And then in the end, they take him to the moon, and there's always this like thread through the background that Superman is aware he can't actually save these children. They have terminal cancer, but the Justice League can take some time out of their day of fighting crime and have superhero fun with them. One shot, Good Night Moon, Superman number 39, the most recent one.
For the ladies. Can't,
for everybody who, you know, needs to see the Justice League be good.
Excellent.
In a, like, pure way.
So before we get to the book that both Dave and I read, I just want to quickly run through the other things that I read, which was I picked up three titles, and then the one we'll talk about. One is called My Favorite Thing is Monsters. These are all 2017 titles. Basically, I read up on like what the people who know what they're talking about thought were the best titles of 2017.
My Favorite Thing is Monsters was drawn with ballpoint pens on lined paper, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
okay, go ahead. That's all I know about it.
I think this was written before 2017, but it came to the U.S. in 2017. So it's being considered a 2017 comic by Emile Ferris. It's a Fantagraphics imprint, and it's, yeah, it looks unlike anything you've seen, outside of like underground alternative comics in like the 90s and stuff like that. And, I didn't really love it, but I like, the ambition of it. It's very cool looking, but I didn't enjoy reading it. So that's my review of My Favorite Thing is Monsters. But you might want to like take a look at it if you want like something very, very different. But in terms of like, I don't know, I never have gotten into like super, super alternative comics. And so it like, I think as I talked before on the Thought Bubble podcast way back when we first launched it, like the comic book as a medium was always challenging for me. So like you can't get uber challenging with a medium that I already found challenging. It's only like a couple of years ago that I finally got on board with like following along storylines. And so basically My Favorite Thing is Monsters was too challenging for me. Another one I picked up that was like sort of alternative, a bit alternative, is Four Kids Walk Into a Bank by Boston Maurer Rosenberg, and this is Black Mask, I think, is the imprint. And the subtitle is A Torrid Tale of Child Crime, and it's about like four kids who are D&D players who get sort of drawn into this other thing. And it sounds like something that I would love, but it was this like weird mismatch of tone. Did you watch Future Man at all on Hulu, the like Seth Rogen, Josh Hutcherson show? That was another show where like I thought it would be for me, but I found the tone really weird and off, and I feel the same way about Four Kids Walked Into a Bank. The art is fun, but the tone is like really funky. So those are my two negative reviews before I get into positive review, which is a DC comic. Like, remember how we used to get knocked all the time for being only talking about Marvel shit?
Yeah.
Here we are talking
about how the world turns.
Here we are talking about DC. Another title I picked up was Mr. Miracle, because I recognized the writer, Tom King, from his work on a Marvel comic, The Vision, which was very, very good. And this is a character I was not familiar, a DC character I was not familiar with, called Mr. Miracle. And it's sort of a classic Jack Kirby, or I don't know, a Jack Kirby character that, Tom King has picked up and Mitch Gerards, I think, is doing the art. The book start, there's five issues out, I think, or six. The book starts with, your superhero, like, having tried to kill himself. So, like, one of the first, you know, frames is like, him in full costume with sliced wrists and blood going everywhere, which is very like Watchmen to me, right? It's not what you would expect at the start of a DC, like a standard DC comic book, I would think. And they just sort of, it's, I mean, if you want to talk about Hallmark movies, it's not a Hallmark movie, but it's a lot about the relationship between this hero, Mr. Miracle, and his wife, Big Barda, who is another superhero and also a sidekick, and sort of how you deal with a suicide attempt in a relationship. And yet also things like Dark Side and Apocalypse, which were bungled so terribly or not done at all in Justice League, are part of this storyline. So there's like classic DC elements, but like Tom King is just, I think, one of the better, maybe the, one of the best writers currently working for the major houses. And it's a very surreal comic, but not in an alienating way. And it's just very creative and an interesting marriage of a creative point of view and relationship, you know, drama with classic DC comic type storylines. So Mr. Miracle, I would really recommend. You can pick up like one issue and see if it's for you. And then the last thing we want to talk about before we get to maybe some film and television.
Oh, hold on. I got Tom King questions. Have you been paying attention to his Batman run?
No, not at all.
Ooh.
Oh.
Can I mildly spoil something for you?
Of course, yeah.
All right, so he did a long run that was pretty good called, I think, The War of Jokes and Riddles. Mm-hmm. You could guess who the villains were. But at the conclusion of that act, Bruce Wayne has proposed marriage to Selina Kyle.
Oh, yeah.
And that's stuck. So there's, like, full-on romance, and that's opened up this whole other dimension between Lois Lane and Selina Kyle. And it's really sort of, I don't know, injected some life into the greater Batman universe, considering he has to interact with people. Like, I like Batman stories like All-Star Batman, where he's sort of like on his own. It's about the Bat characters, or Detective Comics when like the Bat family's in play. Very rarely do I like acknowledging that Batman's in like this huge universe with a lot of people that are maybe super powered and weird. But I love like the double date issue. Issue 37 or something like that, where it's, I don't know, getting close to camp, but still in realistic relationships. So go for King for maybe upending the Batman storyline. Who knows if they actually go through with the wedding? That would be a huge change in status quo, but toying with it, it's proved substantive and not like a twist that was one and done.
Well, he was saying that there were, like, I was reading an interview he gave with Entertainment Weekly where he said that, like, it was no coincidence that the relationship between Batman and Catwoman and the relationship between Mr. Miracle and Big Barda were, like, at the forefront of his comic runs. And the Vision is also about a marriage. He says, like, I'm insanely in love with my wife, basically. And this is the kind of stuff that interests me. And I think, you know, what I found with the Vision, what I found with this comic, and maybe hopefully with that Batman run as well, is, like, it's not – I don't think focusing on that detracts from the feeling of the stories as like classic superhero stories. It just gives your characters humanity and dimension. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
It's especially been nice with like the Batman line in light of Doomsday Clock, because I think sometimes what Marvel, the trap that Marvel fell into with like Secret War is, it's like referencing a nostalgia period in comics isn't as intellectually stimulating as enjoying the characters that are in a like a trapped circumstance. So I feel like Doomsday Clock has the potential to be a really cool domino line to watch get pushed over, but it's because I know that it's sharing the Batman that I get to know in stories like The War of Jokes and Riddles that I sort of can invest a little bit more into it.
So speaking of relationships at the center of a story,
yes,
we want to talk about, you know, another podcast that Dave and I used to do together was called Republic City Dispatch, which is about the Nickelodeon animated TV series, The Legend of Korra. The writers of that show have started a comic book this run is called The Legend of Korra Turf Wars, I believe. It's for Dark Horse, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so we've both read the first issues, but are there three planned issues of this, or what's...
There are going to be three volumes. This is how they've been doing Avatar world storytelling, is it's usually three paperbacks put out over a couple of months. So we've had this with the original Avatar cast a couple of times already. This is going to be our first post-Korra run story. And it does pick up like immediately after the finale of the series.
I should clarify that. Brian Konietzko and Michael Dante DiMartino were the two writers on Korra. It's only DiMartino doing this comic book as far as I can tell. It's not the dream team back together. It's one of the original writers. And it picks up exactly where that finale left off, which was for some people with some ambiguity about the gayness of the main character in Korra. The creators since sort of clarified that, definitely clarified that Korra and her friend Asami are now not just friends, but girlfriends. The comic book's like, in case you had any lingering questions, they're gay together. It starts with them having like a vacation in the spirit world. Korra takes Asami to meet her parents, comes out as gay or at least bi to them. It's so funny. I read this comic the same week I watched the bisexual coming out storyline on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So, it's a good time for like really well done coming out narratives. And then we go into an adventure. And so the aforementioned turf wars of the story. And, the only other experience I have with a comic book that's based on a TV series, like a continuation of a TV series I liked a lot was
Buffy.
Yeah, the Buffy season 8. Comic book. I didn't love the Buffy season 8 comic book the way a lot of people did, but this is a much easier transition for me because, it's from animated to comic book. That's a more natural transition as far as I'm concerned. What did you think of this first volume of Turf Wars?
I like it. It feels like a season of the show more than the previous Avatar lineup comic books felt like those felt like stories that were somewhat essential to the characters in the show, but they didn't feel like an entire season's worth of issues. Korra, when it was on, did a lot about, like crazy urban politics and then global politics and then a whole bunch of refugee stuff and then industrial age issues of urban cities. That's all still here, which is kind of amazing considering how little time they have to work with relatively to an actual runtime of a series. Not only do we have Korra and Asami providing like this or going around deciding when they're going to let who know, not necessarily because they're ashamed about it because they're not, but because Kaya, who also is outed as gay and wasn't on the show, or at least nobody mentioned it on the show, because why would you? Sort of warns them that this could be controversial to some people, as does Korra's father, and Korra takes it in her normal Korra fashion by completely misunderstanding and blowing up at her parents. But that's good. At least it's consistent. The refugees from the spirit portal suddenly opening up in Republic City have created a refugee crisis. So we're sort of back to Korra pretending to, or needing to be the voice of the people to a government, which was a very comfortable place for Legend of Korra to be. Although this time she seems a lot more confident in her avatar abilities, which is, I think, what we've gotten added and what I hope happens more as Turf Wars goes on. Turf Wars definitely introduces a villain for the, I'm going to assume, the next two installments, because he sort of gets a second origin story, I guess would be the way to say it without spoiling it, at the end of Turf Wars Part 1. So it all feels like it's lining up to be so much more Korra at its core than what Avatar managed to pull off with its comic books.
Korra. So for those of you who missed Republic City Dispatch, we've already talked to new father, friend of the pod, Matt Patches, about doing a maybe a Korra-centric episode when this wraps up, when Turf Wars wraps up. So if that's something you've missed and you want to hear us talk about that, and maybe we can even get Devendra Hardwar to join us, that's something that might be on your horizon. So stay tuned.
Yeah, and if you have no idea what we're talking about, you could listen to Republic City Dispatch. We have one podcast for every episode. You could listen along and hear us be wrong about things and right about things.
We occasionally get tweets from people who are watching along with the series, and I'm so embarrassed like about how wrong I was about so many things. So, but they're like, oh, I'm so having so much fun. I'm like, oh, no. Oh, that was, oh, I was so wrong. Okay, anyway. All right, so that's what we've been reading. And if you've been reading anything and want to recommend it to us, you can find us on Twitter, email us, and let us know if, like, what comic books we're missing out on, what we should be keeping up with. I've also, you know, been reading some of the other things that I had been reading previous, like Squirrel Girl and Saga and stuff like that. But these are the new things that I picked up 2 days ago. All right. now we're going to get into, like, a couple of emails. And as far as I know, there's nothing majorly spoilery here, we used to have like a big, you know, basically a storm and a calm section on Thought Bubble. I don't think we're gonna need a storm section for this, but we will. I reserve the right to change my mind. Okay, so this this first email comes from Alan, from Greystones, Ireland. He said I could do this email in an accent, but I'm not going to. He said, just a quick one on the news that there may be a Black Widow movie in 2020 if Trump doesn't kill us all beforehand. Are there any particular Widow standalone stories from comics that would make a good basis for a storyline? Has Romanoff had any one-off adventures or team-ups that would translate well to the screen? Or do you think Marvel Studios would just pen from scratch? Thanks for all the podcasts you guys are involved with. Love them all, and please keep up the great work. So did you have any thoughts on that, Dave?
I haven't been reading Black Widow comics or comics that are Black Widow centric since there has been an Avengers team up movie. So I don't know how they've retrofitted the character in light of the Scarlett Johansson version existing. At least when I was reading Marvel regularly, the Black Widow was at most just like a spy, and she got the spy storylines, but she was like the best spy. So for me, I don't know if there's anything I would pull particularly. I'm tempted to say something from the stuff that I happened across reading because it loops over with Bucky Barnes, but I also think that you could sort of graft Natasha Romanoff onto any spy plot. Like, I would love to see like Mission Impossible 1 just with Natasha Romanoff at the front of it.
Nice.
And like, who gives a shit about the Avengers? Like, now's a good chance. I mean, I don't think they will, because the Marvel Universe has decided that, you know, having two superheroes in one movie is better than having one superhero in one movie. So, you know, even Samuel L. Jackson is showing up for Miss Marvel. But I would, this is an example to maybe do what I've been hoping the Marvel Universe would maybe do a little bit more, which is allow them to break into actual genre. I'm one of the few people on Earth who doesn't count Winter Soldier as a political thriller just because they tell me to.
Are you trying to start something with me?
No, I'm just, you know, setting the ground for people that might be tuning it for the first time.
Neil is not even here to help me, like, push back against your nonsense ideas. Okay, go ahead.
Point being, it's not niche enough for me. It's not doing a play enough to talk to another thing you subtweeted me or actually tweeted at me about, but I didn't have time to respond to today. Logan's actually a good example of this. Doing a Western as a superhero movie is great. Just because I get to be snarky about it doesn't mean that that's not a direction that I think more superhero movies should go in. I want New Mutants to present itself as a horror movie throughout its runtime, but be New Mutants in the future. Like, I'm into splitting up this mono genre now that we've allowed it to have dominance as much as possible. So my hope for a Black Widow movie is start from scratch, but don't start from scratch with the Marvel character. Start from scratch with, like, Ethan Hunt and James Bond or the not Marvel Avengers and work backwards.
All right. So here's what we do know about the Black Widow movie is that they have a writer, Jack Schaefer. Jack is spelled J-A-C. That is a lady. And I have actually seen a movie from Jack Schaefer, the 2009 sci-fi rom-com Timer, which was on Netflix for a really long time, starring Emma Caulfield of Buffy the Vampire Slayer fame. And it was actually pretty good. Like, for a first movie, I thought it was, like, you know, plenty of dudes who have had a first movie as good as Timer have gotten, like, major movies subsequently. And it's been, you know, nearly a decade.
good enough to reboot the Jurassic Park franchise is the bar to clear.
Fair enough. So, you know, it's been almost a decade since she made Timer. She also wrote this movie called Nasty Women, which is a Dirty Rotten Scoundrels remake for Anne Hathaway that's coming out later this year. I know nothing about that. So, we'll, you know, we can all watch that eagerly to see if it, you know, lives up to what you she also has a screenplay on The Blacklist, which is called The Shower, also for Anne Hathaway. Anyway, so that's what we know for certain. Jack Schaefer is attached to Black Widow, not to direct, just to write, as far as we know. In terms, I have read some more recent Black Widow comics. I read the, like, starting 2014, the Nathan Edmondson run, which was just espionage. It wasn't really, like, that closely related to, like, I believe I read it a couple years ago, so forgive me for not remembering. I believe Nick Fury was involved, but not much more. And, like, this is, you know, this is definitely an opportunity, like Captain Marvel is, for there to be more Nick Fury if they want to extend Samuel Jackson's contract. I would expect that the story we get will depend heavily on contracts, because, like, as we were talking about with Infinity War, like, there's a lot of contracts that are up and a lot of people who are going to die. And, like, whenever this movie takes place, like, that, you know, will dictate maybe which actors are available to play in this standalone pool. I don't know if it's going to be, like, a full-on prequel or what. But Dave and I were sort of brainstorming beforehand of, like, you know, what we would want to see from this. And Dave already gave, you know, some good ideas. But one comic book that we both kind of got excited thinking about was not a Black Widow comic, but one called Velvet by Ed Brubaker, who also has done some, I think, some James Bond comics as well. And in addition to a million other things. And Velvet, if you haven't read it, I definitely used to talk about it on Thought Bubble. Great spy comic book. So yeah, I want a mission. I want basically like an episode of Alias with Black Widow. That's what I want. So that's my choice.
Yeah. I mean, do you think they're going to be able to do it without her getting, like, disavowed or crossing the streams? Or do you think it's going to be like a on-the-run movie? Velvet has some aspects of that.
It's going to be really hard to divorce it from the larger storyline. You know what I mean? Like, Black Panther or Captain Marvel, these other characters who have been introduced and now are getting their own standalone, like, it's sort of easy to see, you know, like, with Captain Marvel, they're going to go back in time. With Black Panther, he can just, like, go off to Wakanda, which is super, like, isolated. But it's going to be hard to isolate Natasha unless you do, like, a hardcore prequel to, like, before, pre-Iron Man 2. Watch her get...
Red curly wig, Natasha.
Like, purpley red curly wig. Watching her get some red on her ledger, Natasha. Maybe with Hawkeye in the mix. Who knows? You know, so that's a possibility, but probably not what I would want to see, because I like sort of the evolution we've seen from Natasha so far. So I would prefer to see something later. I mean, if they just want to make Winter Soldier 2, which is basically just Captain America and Natasha, that's like my favorite pairing in universe. So there you go. This next email comes from Kelly, who says, I'm not a big comic book connoisseur, but I am a big Neil Gaiman fan, and I'm midway through the Sandman comics. My question is, what is the likelihood that series becomes a movie or TV show, and who would you like to see play the lead? Okay.
Oh, Kelly. You don't want that. You don't want that, Kelly. I've been where you've been. I've been excited about the possibilities now that, you know, we can do the things that we could do on television and in movies, of the Sandman actually coming. But I don't think we really want the Sandman to become a movie or a TV show. I've thought about how I would want it to become a TV show, and that's you don't reveal it's the Sandman until the end of the first season. It's just
it's like all Legion or something. Like,
basically, like, have you read Sandman?
Yeah.
So it has, like, you know, all these little entrance tales about the people that Dream comes in contact with, and that's essentially what it's cobbled together, and it's not until, like, the end that it really loops everything and exposes itself as this larger, you know, master story of this universe. So, like, you start with, you know, crazy dollhouse story, and you let that run out, and then you like introduce all the crazy people from the Sandman world, and unlike an American Gods or whatnot, you wait till the last possible minute to reveal that the people are more evil and more crazy because they're living in this Neil Gaiman universe. Neil Gaiman is really good, I think, at building those worlds, and it works for me really well in Sandman, and obviously didn't work for me as well in American Gods. So I think that just lulling people into Neil Gaiman's storyteller with, like, these little twisted tales would be much better than the bold thing that they've tried, which is, like, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's going to be the Sandman. It's going to be one movie. I'm like, no.
Yeah, that's a terrible
please,
idea. Yeah.
Please don't do any of that. If I did want to see Dream played by somebody, it would be an entirely performance capture performance. I think that's one of the times that you could lean into something not looking real, Joanna, if it was Dream.
We really do need Neil here, so it's not just me disagreeing with you. Okay, so here's what I'll say. I'm probably in a better place now to concede Dave's point of 2017, which is that American Gods is a very problem-riddled adaptation. I was in a bit of denial about it last year just because I really wanted that show to succeed, and it's like it's in some rocky territory development-wise. So here's what I'll say. So American Gods, which was a TV adaptation of a Neil Gaiman story we saw last year, had problems. I'll be very curious to see what happens with Good Omens, which is the one that Neil Gaiman's currently working on that he's acting as showrunner on. Like, he basically got his, like, crash course in showrunning watching what Brian Fuller and Michael Green did on American Gods. And he's like, okay, now I'm doing this one on my own. And he said that, like, he thinks he's kind of good at it and he doesn't really love doing it. He prefers writing, but, like, he doesn't feel like he doesn't know what he's doing with Good Omens. So I'll be very curious to see what happens with Good Omens. Let's say Good Omens is good. And then I'm like, okay, well, then I could see Neil Gaiman maybe doing a TV, because Good Omens, you know, if they're smart, Good Omens will only be max 3 seasons. It really should just be 1 season, but, you know, who knows? Okay, so having said all of that, I agree kind of with Dave that, like, you don't want a direct adaptation of the Sandman Chronicles, but, like, something... Chronicles, where did that come from? But something that you said that really stuck with me is, I think you said storyteller. You're just referring to Neil Gaiman as a storyteller, but it made me think of that Jim Henson.
The storyteller. Yeah. You don't have to say anything more. I know exactly. I'm sorry. For listeners, it was a television show from Drew Heppett's Muppet Studio that would tell fables and enact them with human and puppet characters.
Hosted by the late great John Hurt and as the storyteller. And so I started to think about, like, the Sandman as, like, building off what you just said, the Sandman as, like, an anthology series. Like, not an anthology series, like anthology episodes. Like each like Tales from the Crypt, basically. Like each episode is sort of like another, you know, journey into the world of Sandman and stuff like that. I don't think it will make sense to try to tell a coherent thing, but to try to tell little, like, one-off fables in this same world using some recurring actors, I think could be really fun.
Yeah, I think you could build to the huge thing, but the thing is, like, Sandman, the world and the ethos behind it is so huge that I feel like trying to start there and distill it down, like, you get the Dark Tower movie. If you try that, just like a whole bunch of nothing that means nothing because people thought it would be enough to lure fans in who had actually experienced the full thing. that's not what I want. I would like it to grow somehow. I didn't finish Overture, which I'm just realizing now that we're talking about it.
Wasn't great.
So, oh, okay.
in my
maybe
opinion.
Maybe I'm fine with it. But like the idea that this world does have a bunch of space in it to create stories makes me less excited to see an adaptation of what we would consider the main Sandman arc.
And if we were to have a Jim Henson's The Storyteller-esque version of Sandman, the person I would like to play the Sandman is Tom Hiddleston in Only Lovers Left Alive mode.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
just Tilda Swinton.
You want
Dream to actually come off the page looking like he's in The Cure, like
maybe
straight up.
Maybe.
All right.
Anyway, if you haven't read Sandman, it's something that I sort of resisted for a while only because of my weird comic book issues. And then finally, like, just got completely sucked into it and plowed through the whole thing, I think, in the span of a month or something like that. So good. So, obviously, Sandman, classic, Neil Gaiman. Read it. Decide for yourself if you think it should be a TV series. I think we're both in agreement that it shouldn't be a movie just because there's just too much to do with that. All right. This email comes from Michael Keo, who says, when I saw your Thought Bubble tweet, I immediately wanted to pitch a question regarding Brian K. Vaughan oeuvre. After taking a few practice swings, I remembered I've only read Saga and The Runaways. Still, without a meaty question for you, I'll serve up a request instead. I'd love to hear you guys discuss A, the two aforementioned series, B, The Runaways on Hulu, and or C, which of his other series you particularly enjoy. Sorry I don't have my best stuff here. I trust you can still knock one out of the park. Get well soon, Neil. From Michael. Yes, get well soon, Neil. I agree with that.
Don't fall down.
Don't fall down, like, literally or, you know, immune deficiency-wise. Yeah, so Brian K. Vaughan, the great Brian K. Vaughan. I think I'm gonna step in front of this train because I think Dave and I are gonna have the same answer probably, which is why The Last Man, right? In terms of a Brian K. Vaughan series that has yet to be adapted, but maybe will by Noah Hawley and FX at some point.
Yes. Oh, we're just talking about what series we particularly enjoy. I mean, yes, Why The Last Man, of course. It's great. If you don't know what it is, all the men die except for one man and his monkey. And then the rest of that, it goes forward. It is not a comic, like, comedy setup, even though it kind of sounds like that. It's not horribly sexually violent, which is what I feared when I picked up the first issue, just with the premise. It is a pretty great story for a lot of other reasons that are best left discovering while reading it, but it exists in a completion. It ended on its own terms. It's a full story. So if you want to pick that up in its entirety, I think it's a good place to start with Brian K. Vaughan, as opposed to like Saga or Runaways or things where it's either ongoing or the definitive arc is under debate. Why The Last Man exists in its entirely and is its own definitive work.
Well, and so, you know, to get a mood sense of Why The Last Man, his work on Why The Last Man is why Damon Lindelof hired him to write on Lost, which he did. Brian K. Vaughan wrote on the TV series Lost. So I think it is a lot like that. Like a group of people, I mean, I guess sort of like The Walking Dead too, like a group of people that you care about trying to navigate unfamiliar societal territory, but better than The Walking Dead and more cleanly resolved, I think, probably than Lost wound up being. Paper Girls is also a good series by Brian K. Vaughan. As for The Runaways, I spoke erroneously. Apparently, Michael Green, who was on American Gods and like wrote Blade Runner and Murder on the Orient Express and like 9 other movies this year. I think he also co-wrote Logan. So I think he's Oscar nominee, Michael Green. In terms of the Hulu show Runaways, I have not finished it, but I really liked it. To the point, I think I saw 7 episodes and I really, really liked it. It was, I think, one of like three comic book TV shows I liked last year when there were like a million comic book TV shows last year. Where are you with the Hulu Runaways, Dave?
I think caught up. I think I've seen the first season, right? Because they are on break now, the second season.
Yeah.
So yes, I like it. I wish there were less of the parents in it. I understand why they're doing it. And the dynamic that adds isn't unwanted. I'm just kind of done with it now. As somebody that, you know, forced her to introduce to the Runaways and Brian K. Vaughan's volumes, the titular running away was very ponderous.
Yes.
In season one.
Very true. I thought they were going to run away at the end of like episode two, and then they just kept staying.
Yeah. And I, like I said, I see why I did it. It's just, if I were to change anything for season two, which I will definitely retain my Hulu subscription to see, it would, be let the kids who are for the most part doing a really good job, build on that somehow.
Okay. So that is a,
Wait, can I do my part now?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Of course. No, I was just going to say, I was going to encapsulate the Hulu thing, which is like, that's our,
Oh yeah.
I would say moderate positive endorsement of Hulu's The Runaways. Like, at least it has very strong potential, if not like the best comic book TV show you've ever seen in your entire life. So,
right. And you have time to let these things simmer now because they don't, you know, have one season to prove themselves anymore.
It's true. And then the rest of your answer, please. Yes.
I was just going to give a nod to something I enjoyed, maybe because I read it while it was happening, and I don't know, the world was different. Brian K. Vaughan's Ex Machina. It's about this man who's the only superhero of his world. He's called the Great Machine, and because he rescues so many people on 9/11, he gets elected the mayor of New York City. And the reality of politics and a critique of superheroes in general follows. I really enjoyed it. It's really sometimes nail on the head with Bush era reckonings, but you know, from like 2004 to 2010-ish when this was running, that's what I wanted. So yeah, if you want to check out some Brian K. Vaughan that also exists completely, but is maybe overlooked, maybe for correct reasons, you could be the judge with Ex Machina.
Excellent. So the great Brian K. Vaughan, someone we definitely recommend generally. And then I guess, you know, people have wondered over the years whether or not Saga should, I mean, Saga is definitely something that's been talked about in terms of adapting into film or television. And I was like, no, until someone was like, Tessa Thompson for the lead. And I was like, maybe. So, you know.
Ooh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's how I want Saga to happen.
Okay.
Tessa Thompson's in the lead.
Yeah.
Brian K. Vaughan writes it.
Yeah.
Wes Ball directs it.
Who's Wes Ball?
He is the director of the Maze Runner movies.
Oh my God.
Wait. Have you seen any of the Maze Runner movies?
No.
Okay.
I just like, we've talked about this before. We've talked about your Maze Runner affinity. I support it. Right, well, I support it.
We talk about this on the, I think, briefly on Fighting in the War Room this week too, but the guy is a really talented director. He made a short that was entirely CG. That was about a robot riding a motorcycle through like a Vine City. Like, not really important plot wise, but that's what got him the Maze Runner job. On the Maze Runner, he would do like an insane number of setups a day, like 20 some setups to like get this movie done. He has everything storyboarded out. He is one of these directors. We don't know yet. Because he hasn't, you know, had any time to exist outside of this franchise. If he is like a Ridley Scott or James Cameron level person, but he does, he does that. I'm not talking about execution. He does that level of planning for sure. So he knows this world. He knows how to visually build it out, and he knows how he wants to shoot it to the point that he becomes a really efficient director. I feel like you throw him in there and let him do what is an insane visual world for Saga that you're going to have. Like, if you think Taika Waititi Thor was a crazy Tessa Thompson, West Ball off the chain, Tessa Thompson would be like five times crazier.
Awesome. All right, this next email is like such a, I can't wait to hear what Dave is thinking right now in the subject email, which comes from someone I know his real name, but he prefers we call him Peter, as in Peter Baelish. And he writes, I was wondering if you could talk about each of your biggest unresolved questions and concern regarding the pending Fox Disney sale. If you both think this is only tangentially a thoughtful question, I totally understand. But aside from fearing media mergers in and of themselves, I personally am already anticipating missing Fox's increasingly experimental takes on their characters, including Legion, additional New Mutant horror films, and even Deadpool, plus Noah Hawley's supposed Doctor Doom project and a story where we'd see Laura from Logan as Wolverine. So, yeah, answering this in a comic book context doesn't mean that Dave and I are ignorant of the larger ramifications of a Fox-Disney merger. But, you know, comic book properties is part of them. Or you can answer it in a larger scale. So, Dave, like, since we talked about this, I think, I mean, definitely back in early December we talked about this. So, like, what are you thinking these days about it?
Well, I guess if there's going to be a time to not think about it as a horrible business deal that signals horrible things and just talk about the comic book properties, this is probably the place to do it. I've been trying to avoid doing it on Twitter so people realize it's a serious issue.
Right.
But let's talk about comic book properties.
Okay.
Yes, I'm super worried. I'm super worried that everything is going to be Disney-fied, which is just going to dull it. I think even if they give lip service to continuing Deadpool with, like, Deadpool 3 still R-rated, and, you know, Ryan Reynolds could do whatever PR he wants.
Right.
He could be in a porno. We don't care. I think that might just end up being lip service to what would still be a muted R. So if you could flip the switch from what we now call, thanks to another superhero movie, The Dark Knight PG-13... that could just as easily be an R with one more shot of blood, and people would release it as being like, oh yeah, this is our more hardcore movie, because I don't think people have really connected what was done with Logan and what was done with people. I don't think the people in charge of deciding what superhero movies are next have really connected Deadpool with telling a good Deadpool story and Logan with capping off this fantastic Hugh Jackman run with something with actual substance as being the result of like where the superhero movie greater historical possession is in, or the greater historical projection is in time.
Yeah.
I think what they think is that R-rated superhero movies, people must really want it. That's why I want New Mutants to be a horror film, like Peter mentions. That would be a great weird genre thing to do. We already know what a team of mutants are. Why not see it in like a different context? Disney's not interested in that. If Disney's handling a Pixar and the Star Wars property and the Muppets is anything as any indication of the way they treat popular things that they acquire, they're going to find the most marketable center to that. Kermit the Frogs in a movie. I like with the Muppets, it was really basic because they weren't really able to like launch that back out.
Yeah.
But if you think, you know, Disney like immediately put in more Toy Story sequels, they immediately allowed more Cars sequels, all this sort of post Pixar buying things. That's where the land of Pixar sequels really started cooking up. So what we're looking at is what makes these characters profitable in the eyes of Disney, and I think what that's going to end up being is crossover potential, not the actual characters. I don't think they give a shit that they have Colossus and so they finally have a mutant who could turn metal. I think they're excited the X-Men could now meet the MCU in the future, but they don't have to. So it's like The joke is that, like, for a certain period of Marvel Comics, they just added Wolverine to everything. They can now just do that for the movies if they want. Disney is capable of running the Marvel properties all in one place, with the exception of Namor and the Hulk, for the first time ever. And I think the potential of that is much more valuable than trying to hold on to somebody else's formula. So the Disney formula, or the Marvel Disney formula, is crossovers and interconnectivity at this point. I've seen nothing business-wise to make me think that that's not the value they also see in the new superhero properties they have. The thing that you loved about these characters when you were reading comic books about them is that they, you know, could all show up together, and now finally that could happen. And because of this, like, artificial competition that, like, you know, we need to have the X-Men, or the Marvel Cinematic Universe isn't complete. Spider-Man needs to come home, or Marvel's, like, not actually complete. That even further feeds the thing, when really it's all, like, nonsense. We're living in the ultimate future right now, where all these people get movies. Like, it doesn't get better than this. This is the goal.
All right. I hear you, and I respect the way that you haven't, like, made this a thrust of your argument as to why you're concerned, and like the point you make about Pixar is decent. I hadn't thought about, like, the sequelizing, and sort of maybe that's a result of Disney just being like, we know this thing works, so let's just keep doing this thing we know works. That being said, I mean, like, I don't know that it's, at least with, like, if you look at Pixar or Lucasfilm or other properties, I don't know that it's as dire as all that, in terms of, like, it's not like there's no experimentation, but it is very much a, like, we know what works, so let's just keep doing that, with some added room for experimentation. I don't know. I'm happy to be alarmist about mergers generally, and media conglomerates all sort of becoming one. But in terms of specifics of, you know, like the Fox Marvel properties, I sort of feel kind of wait and see about it. Like, let's wait and see what happens to Deadpool. I mean, plus this merger is not even going to go into effect for, I think it's like 16 months or some 12 months, 16 months, something like that, 18 months. So, like, you know, there's time for us to figure it all out, but I know that.
Well, I mean, there's a way it could work out good. Like, whatever works could work out in our favor, and just giving us something that we kind of think we want, but we don't know what we want. Like, if the first time Wolverine shows up in the MCU, it's Laura, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And, like, yes, please. Like, there's no way that could have happened without all previous Wolverine movies existing. So if they're able to capitalize on that part of the property, and, like, you know, one development executive is like, you know, really, I feel passionate about keeping this actress on, that could be amazing. So it's like, I don't know if I'm worried. My worries are, is that Disney's Disney, and they don't really care about the artistic output of these things. You have to have your Kathleen Kennedys and your Feiges and your serial sexual harassment.
I was going to be like, what are you going to say there?
To sort of tweak things up in a creative fashion and, like, lord over it. Warner Brothers is trying to say right now, you know, the DCEU is too big for one person to run it, but there still has to be a general sense of direction. Disney's is much more about profitability than it is about exploring interesting avenues. But I do think something like what we're going to see Sony go through with the upcoming, not MCU Spider-Man movies, is going to be really interesting, because they're going to get this juice of creativity from being limited, from not wanting to use all of their shared pie. Like, I think there's a way that occasionally business makes a good idea, and I think that's where we have to hope for now, because the Fox Disney sale is just so massive, and it's so many characters, and it's so many people who have, like, an identity with those characters. Like, you know, good luck casting another Professor X and not asking Patrick Stewart first. You're going to get murdered.
Yeah.
Like, good luck doing anything with Ryan Reynolds and Deadpool. So they have, you know, a certain number of chips that are going to fall where they may. I can only hope for accidental progress, because I don't think actual I don't know, maturing of these brands is in their mind.
And maybe Gambit will actually get made. All right.
That's up to Channing Tatum.
Don't hold your breath, Cher. All right. So the last thing I'm going to say before we go for today is a really, 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 I think, philosophical, thought-provoking question, which is, oh my God, Dave, did you see the photo of Brie Larson in her flight suit? And even though it's not a costume for the film, like on a scale of 1 to 10, how hype are you right now?
I haven't, so I'm Googling it now in flight suit. I mean, I'm hype. I'm hype because Samuel Jackson also did a random roles on the AV Club and was like sounded interesting and like interested in doing Captain Marvel, which I'm like, yeah, yeah. So yeah, I'm super into it. I'm happy that eventually we're gonna get to see the Skrulls,
yeah,
because of a long history of Skrull denying and debates about whether or not the Skrulls can be in anything, and then we'll just buy the company. So I'm sure there was a whole deal that went down for that to happen, and then now it's, you know, X'd out. But, you know, hopefully that means maybe Super Skrulls for Captain Marvel, which couldn't have happened before. I'm looking at the flight suit now.
I mean,
I'm pretty hyped.
I don't know that it's her costume, but I think it's just her, like, training on how to fly. And
I was as psyched with that, and then there was also a picture of her and Tessa Thompson watching something on her Instagram, and I was like, yes! Future of Marvel team-ups isn't two guys named Chris meeting each other.
I think that was a Time's Up meeting. it's them sitting, watching intently someone talk about sexual assault in Hollywood. But still, yay, ladies working together. I saw the photo today. It's just her like training, probably learning how to convincingly like hold onto a steering wheel and look at gauges. But I'm excited. Captain Marvel, it's happening. It's all happening. It's all going to happen. So, those are all my thoughts that I wanted to bubble right now today with you, Dave. Thank you guys all for your emails. We got a few more that we couldn't get to. If you're sitting there, like one of our listeners says, like white knuckling in anger because we haven't talked about Black Panther, that's because we're going to do a whole Black Panther episode when that movie comes out. But trust that we are really, really excited for it. Excited that the ticket sales are like off the charts already. Really hope it just like lives up to all the hopes and expectations people have.
I want it to be Infinity Wars. Like that's petty, but like considering they're both going to do really well, I want the end box office of Black Panther to be over the movie with 36 Avengers in it.
I mean,
thank you.
It could be. It's like kind of crazy what's happening with pre-sales on this. That being said, like that's the story on the old internets. But when I went to go buy my tickets for it in the same place where I usually buy tickets for these sort of things, it was a lot easier to get tickets for this than it has been for Marvel movies in the past. So I don't know if like San Francisco's just like racist or what, but there you go.
Interesting. Yes, let's end with calling San Francisco racist.
Why not? Hometown, San Francisco. All right. We will be back next week with Neil Miller, and we'll be going somewhere else on our off-season tour.
We will. Maybe debating something?
Maybe, if that's what we decide to do. Thank you guys also for all your great debate suggestions. That was also great. I think actually we're supposed to do a mailbag next week. We'll see what happens to us. But in the meantime, Dave, where can people find your work?
Oh, you could find me on Twitter at DA7E and the podcast at stormofspoilers.com, and make sure to follow us on Twitter at stormofspoilers so we could tell you what to write in with next week, because if it's a mailbag or it's a great debate, we're going to need help from you, the listener, and your many white-knuckled opinions next week on Star Wars Spoilers.
You can also follow Neil Miller on Twitter at Rejects. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can hear me talking about American Crime Story Versace on the Still Watching podcast that Dave is helping us with over on Vanity Fair. You can hear me talking about the Oscar nominations that came out today on the Vanity Fair or a couple days ago when you're listening to this, on the Vanity Fair podcast, Little Gold Men. And then I will see you all next next week. Thank you for listening.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.